This friendship morning was something that we planned to happen 2 years ago. It was the first casualty of COVID, basically, where we were in that slightly uncertain period where if you had a sniffle or a cold of some sort, you thought, have I got this virus that they're talking about on the news? And I, in the week in the run-up to it, I got that sniffle. And then kind of people were like, shouldn't we be doing stuff? This was all just a few days before that first lockdown. And so we thought, better safe than sorry. Let's postpone the day. We can always do it in September or something like that. Well, 2 years later, here we are. And honestly, we thought the day was a necessary and important thing to think about 2 years ago. 2 years further on, it's even more important, I think, as a subject to think about. Because of, as I've put on the first heading there, the state of friendship in 2022. We live in a moment where I think we have a high need of friendship. Very high need of friendship. For a few different reasons, but I've put three on your sheet there. First being the breakdown of family relationships. There's a guy called David Brooks. He's a journalist who writes for the New York Times in America. Recently he wrote an article reflecting on the effects of the Industrial Revolution on support networks and relationships. And he basically argued how before the Industrial Revolution, the majority of people lived in the countryside and operated either kind of running farms or cottage industries and that kind of thing. And to run those industry is not the right word, is it? Those enterprises effectively, what you needed was an extended family network. So families always lived relatively close to each other and all kind of plowed into the same enterprise together, which meant that just in society generally, there was this fabric of relationships that provided support networks for anyone and everyone. But then the Industrial Revolution happened. Some parts of the world is still happening. And what happened was a massive migration at that point from the countryside into the cities in ways that tore apart those fabrics, those support networks. And what happened all of a sudden was that the emphasis relationally went from the extended family and other networks to the nuclear family, you know, the kind of classic husband, wife, 2.4 kids. That in the city was where the kind of relational emphasis was. That was what carried the burden of support for anyone. But the weight of pressure on that was so large that what happened often was the pressure caused a fracture and divorce rates suddenly increased in cities because nuclear families weren't designed to carry all that weight of pressure and support. And so even then, the nuclear family broke down, which meant that for the majority of the world living increasingly in urban settings, they just didn't have the support networks that traditionally had been enjoyed. And you and I still live in something of the aftermath of that, in ways that means that historic support networks are no longer there for us, which means we need friends. Secondly, the fragmentation of society more generally. We now live in this hyper-mobile world, people traveling around all the time, huge amounts of migration for all kinds of reasons, which means that there has been in the UK, but in other parts of the world and in all cities, huge migration into those cities of all kinds of different ethnicities and cultures and backgrounds. Now, what would be wonderful is if all of those different cultures and ethnicities all just sort of moved in and mingled together and formed communities with a wonderful diversity and expression of culture in ways that everybody enjoyed all of that. Now, in London, you do get a little bit of that, don't you? There is a wonderful diversity that we can enjoy. But the reality on the grounds of multiculturalism is not of tightly knit, interwoven, diverse communities, but rather of hermetically sealed communities living next to each other, barely knowing each other. You know, for example, we live with huge numbers of Muslims around us here in East London, and I have very little meaningful interaction with them as a community, and yet they're on my doorstep. And that's replicated again and again throughout London, communities that aren't interwoven with each other, but rather exist separately from each other. Hypermobility means you've got these diverse groups coming in and remaining apart, and at the same time, large numbers of people moving out all of the time. Our hyper-mobile existence leads to a degree of transience. In well, almost wherever you live in the UK, cities, towns, wherever it is, as people move from, you know, one job to the next job, to the next job, to the next job, one home to the next home, to the next home, to the next home. And both of those things mean we live in an increasingly fragmented society in a way that means we need friends. And then you add in the pressure of the last 2 years that is COVID-19, something that for 2 years on and off pulled us apart from each other and meant that for times of necessity, we were kind of, literally almost locked in our rooms, unable to relate to each other. And the aftermath of which, unless we're very careful and thoughtful about this, will mean that we remain in that place. The working from home revolution means everyone's going to be sitting in their rooms all day, every day, working away without relationships, unless we're careful and thoughtful about that. And that two-year period meant that we, in all of our relationships, experienced a kind of a loosening and a distancing from each other in ways that even in church life means as we kind of re-emerge from that place, we feel in society, in church, wherever it is, at least at this moment, a degree of dislocation. Because all our relationships kind of changed and shifted and moved on somewhat so that we come to church maybe on a Sunday morning post-COVID feeling it's a slightly different place to where it was 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And the risk is that there's an isolation that flows out from that, which means we need friends. We have a high need of friendship, but I think it's fair to say in our culture, a low view of friendship. A low view of friendship. Again, for any number of reasons, we could list loads of them. Just Facebook referring to an acquaintance for whom you click on a button, referring to them as a friend has immediately diminished our understanding of friendship. But lots of things like that. Here's two things in particular, though, that I think have had a negative effect on our view of friendship. The fact that we've been told that we should have other much higher priorities. So we've been sold the myth, and I use the word sold intentionally because I think it's advertisers, by and large, who have done this job. We've been sold the myth that if you're going to be happy in life, what you need is a certain kind of lifestyle and probably a certain kind of job. A job that will bring you happiness and fulfillment and meaning and significance and a lifestyle that flows out from that. And because that's been so sold so hard and so effectively to us as a culture, we live in a place where we're kind of willing to drop everything else to go and get those things, including friendships that we might have. So I was talking to someone recently who was lamenting the loss of two good friends of his. And he was talking about how both of these friends had taken jobs in other parts of the world, one on the other side of the world and one in a country not far from here, and in both cases had chosen to go to places where they had no friends whatsoever, no meaningful relationships at all to start with, and were leaving quite tightly knit networks of friendships in order to do that. And he was talking to me about the conversation he had with one of them. He was talking about actually his wife's job. He said, his friend had said to him, look, in terms of my wife's work, they've offered us double the salary that she's on at the moment, which meant the decision in the end was just a no-brainer. And my friend was like, just thinking this through, saying, so you've moved away from all of your friends for double the salary. Just says an interesting thing, doesn't it, about the values of that decision and the values of our society. Leave all your friends behind for the money. We've been told, I think, we should have other much higher priorities than friendship. And in our society, we have a very inflated view of romance. So our society thinks that the highest form of human relationship that you should pursue at all costs is romance, even if that's at the expense of friendship. You can tell this. I was listening to Tim Keller talk about these things, the pastor from New York. He said you can tell this by walking into a shop, a newsagent's or a supermarket, and walking up to the magazine rack. He says if you look at the gossip magazines, they never say things like, have you seen how Tom Cruise and Ryan Reynolds have struck up a really good friendship? Oh, isn't that interesting? Oh, I'll buy that. I want to read about how they're buddies all of a sudden. No, so it's talking about who's marrying who, isn't it? Or who's struck up a romance with whom. Those are the things that sell the magazines, not the friendships. Because in our society, we don't really think friendship is a very big deal. We do think romance is a very big deal. If you get romance, you get everything. That's the relationship you need. In ways that means in our society, people will neglect friendship to pursue romance. Kind of ditch your friends, diminish the amount of time you spend with friends because you're pursuing Mr. Right or Mrs. Right. And when you get that relationship, Mr. Right, Mrs. Right, whoever it is, marriage, you leave your other friends behind because you've got the one relationship that really counts as far as our society is concerned. However it works out, we've been sold that myth as well, that the highest form of relationship is romantic relationship, when the Bible sees things very, very differently. So why don't we just take a pause, and I'm going to give you a chance just to talk in groups for 5 minutes or so. I want to know how you are feeling about friendship generally post-COVID. Lots of you filled out that survey in advance. Let me give you one of the statistics to come from it. I think Andrew's going to talk in more detail about that later on in the morning. We asked you the question, how did COVID lockdowns affect your relationships with close friends? Don't know what you make of these statistics. 63% of people said, I'm close with some, I'm more distant with others. 16% of people said no change at all. 11% of people said more distance. And 7% said closer. So it's a slight trend, but the trend generally was towards distance in relationships. But pretty much everyone acknowledged that it had changed their friendships. So just for 5 minutes or so in your groups, talk about how you're feeling about friendship post-COVID. Okay, I don't really want to interrupt your conversations because I suspect loads of really good things are being said, but I'm going to draw us together. Do carry those conversations on over coffee, okay? Let's make the most of the morning we've got together to be talking about and thinking about these things. I said a moment ago, didn't I, that in our society, romance is the highest form of relationship. Marriage is the goal to which you aspire. Sometimes I think that's not helped by the church, where in the church we can focus on marriage or focus on the image of marriage as the relationship with God that we're looking forward to and want to enjoy. Now, that is right. Revelation 21 at the end of the Bible pictures the consummation of all things as the church, as the bride of Christ, being united with him perfectly once and for all. It's a wonderful picture. It's a beautiful picture of the intimacy that we're going to enjoy. But it's not the exclusive picture of our relationship with God. And sometimes that image is put forward, I think, at the expense of the picture of the relationship we have with God that is friendship. The Bible wants to push friendship high up the priority list of relationships we have, because just as high as marriage is in God's picture scheme, so too is friendship. The new relationship we have with God is described as a friendship that we have with him. The Bible starts with this wonderful scene. We never actually see it realized in practice because of sin, but just after the fall, God is described as walking in the garden in the cool of the day. He comes down, as it were, and does so with an expectation that he's going to walk with Adam and Eve. He comes looking for them. And so from the very earliest moments, you get depicted this scene, as it were, in our minds, of Adam and Eve walking with God. Walking with God. And the Bible continues to pick up that imagery, walking with God. It describes Enoch in chapter 5 as walking with God, as a picture of closeness, of relationship. But we know how the story goes from the Garden of Eden, don't we? Sin breaks in. Adam and Eve, as it were, say to God, we don't want to be friends with you anymore. And God gives them what they want and righteously puts them out of the garden. But God is the perfect friend, God our Father. And so he pursues humanity. He doesn't just let them walk away. He pursues them. And at the earliest moment when God, as it were, formally steps towards humanity again, in the covenant with Abraham, We get this moment described. God steps back towards humanity and towards Abraham. And the book of James, you've got the reference there. The book of James, chapter 2, verse 23 says this. Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. You see, at the moment God steps back towards humanity and reinstates the relationship, how is it described? As friendship. The next big covenant in the Bible story is the covenant with Moses that God makes. Moses and the people of Israel through him. And Moses is the mediator of that covenant, and he enjoys all of the blessings of it. In the book of Exodus, you see him coming and going from the tabernacle, the place where God dwells, to go and spend time with God. And in Exodus chapter 33, verse 11, it says this, "The Lord used to speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend." That's the nature of the relationship that Moses enjoyed with God. And then Jesus arrives on the scene as the climax of all of God's covenants, the epitome of God stepping towards humanity. And in Matthew chapter 11, verse 19, he is described as a friend of tax collectors and sinners. He pursues those who are out of relationship with him and know it. And like the perfect friend, doesn't wait for them to come to him, but instead pursues them. And I'd love you to turn to John chapter 15. You've got Bibles on your tables if you'd like to do that. To turn to John chapter 15, because here, as I've read already this morning, we see Jesus describing the essence of that friendship. John chapter 15. I'm just going to read verses 12 to 15. So this is Jesus talking. It's the night before he goes to the cross. He's having this last evening with his disciples, and he says this to them. "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone laid down his life for his friends. You are my friends, if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you." Jesus says to the disciples who have been following him around for 3 years, "You are my friends." And in these verses describes the essence of that friendship. It is a friendship that is expressed in total sacrifice. When Jesus says, verse 13, "Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends," he's talking in general terms, but we as readers of John's gospel know there's also a specificity to that. He is going to be the one who will do that, who will lay down his life for his friends, which means Jesus is the perfect friend. He is the one who gives up everything in order to give us everything. He's the one who sees us in adversity, as it were, and who comes towards us to rescue us. And as he does that, so he enables a forgiveness of sins and a righteousness that means we will always have his approval. We will always have his approval. He will always want to be with us. He will never leave us or forsake us. And as he does that, so he gives us a security of relationship that means he can be a true friend to us. He can encourage us and he can challenge us. He can even rebuke us, because as he does that, we know the friendship isn't going to be at stake. And he shows in that one act of the cross a love that means he will always be for us. We sung it already, didn't we? Jesus, friend of sinners. This is the heart and the whole of the Christian life, that we get to be friends with God, that we get to be friends with Jesus, and that he is the perfect friend. And we've got to know this, we've got to be convinced of this before we start talking about the practice of friendship and the pattern of friendship and those kind of things. Because as we're convinced of this, that in Jesus Christ we have the perfect friend who will always meet our needs and always satisfy us in the ways that we need things, it will in turn reorder our approach to friendship with human beings. Because for some of us, it will relieve us of the burden of having too high a set of expectations. Sometimes I think we can fall into the trap of expecting our friends to to never let us down. That's what we expect of friends. They will never let us down. Our friends are people who will always satisfy us. They will always be there for us. They will meet our deepest need. That's the trap we can fall into. We expect them, as it were, to be like Jesus. And if we have that higher set of expectations for our friends, that means, as a result, we will always be disappointed by people. We will always carry around with us a slight sense of bitterness and disappointment. It'll mean we're always slightly insecure in our friendships because we're expecting something of people that we shouldn't necessarily expect. And our tendency will be to want to sort of grab them a bit harder than perhaps we should because we're expecting something of them that we shouldn't necessarily. And that can result in moving from one place to the next because you're always a bit disappointed by a certain group of people. They've disappointed you, let you down, so you move up and you move on to the next place, hoping that that group of people will fulfill all of those expectations. But when the friendship of Jesus Christ satisfies us in the ways that he says it will, that then liberates us. Because I don't need my friends to be Jesus for me, because Jesus can be Jesus for me. And I can handle those moments when friends aren't perfect and they let me down, because I have someone I can fall back on who will meet my deepest needs. For some of us, it will liberate us from having too high a set of expectations from our friends. From others, too low a set of expectations. Maybe that, for example, you've been burned before by friendship. You carry with you the scars of friends that have failed you in some way or another. Or maybe years of living in London with all of the pressures that London life brings on you has kind of hardened you to friendship, or has resulted in you just deciding to choose other priorities. You've decided to some extent or another, you're kind of going solo through life. But when the love of Jesus Christ fills your heart, it's not like petrol being poured into a tank that is kind of sealed off and powers you to go solo. Now, when the love of Jesus Christ fills your heart, it's more like a fountain that is meant then to overflow towards others. When the friendship of Jesus Christ is first and foremost in your mind, that love spills out towards others and pushes you out towards others. It makes you think to yourself, actually, I want to be there for other people. I want to grow relationships with other people. I want to serve other people as I have been served. It lifts our expectations of friendship. And so whatever else we do as a result of this morning, whatever else we come out thinking, we need to be those who fix our eyes on Jesus, the true and perfect friend that we all need. Because as we do that, we will find the power for a healthy approach to friendship. But we will also see in Jesus the pattern of friendship. The pattern of friendship. You see, there's lots of different kinds of friendship, aren't there? I'm guessing if I sent you back into groups to talk, you could come up with an endless list of types of friends that you have. There's the BFF, okay? I don't know who came up with this BFF thing, but we know what we mean by it, don't we? The best friend forever. Right, there's that kind of friend, and that's a wonderful thing. But then there's loads of other types of friendships, aren't there? There's the work friend. There's the football friend. There's the school friend. There's the long-distant friend. There's the old friend. There's the new friend. There's the friend of a friend of a friend. And we could kind of go on, couldn't we? I think sometimes we get a bit obsessed by, a bit caught up with the BFF. That's what we think is really friendship. And if we don't have that, we think, I haven't really got friends. Now, there's all kinds of different friendships that we can and we should enjoy, but I think if they're going well as friendships, to some degree or another, they will both have these two things in common. The first being a common passion. And I think we see Jesus talk about this in John chapter 15. So John chapter 15, verse 15, he says this. He says, "No longer do I call you friends." No longer do I call you servants. Somewhat undermine the message of the morning, wouldn't it? "No longer do I call you servants, For the servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. What is it that enables this group of people with Jesus to transition from being called servants to being called friends? Well, he says halfway through verse 15, I call you friends because all that I have heard from my Father, I have made known to you. The story of John's gospel is the story of Jesus Christ, the Word, fully God in eternity with his Father, in an eternal love relationship, who comes down to earth to bring, as he says again and again, words from the Father, this incredible message of divine love, these eternal realities that he wants to express to the world and to share with the world. That's why Jesus comes into the world. And now here, in these last moments he says, look, I have shared these things with you. All that I've heard from my Father, I have made known to you. And the message of John's gospel is that that group of people will then take that out to the worlds. He says, now we have this in common, this eternal reality that I've been enjoying since eternity. And I've shared it with you so that now we can be called friends. We have, as it were, a common passion, a common commitment. And this is true, actually, every time a friendship starts. Friendships form over things to do, don't they? Maybe it's a football team that you have in common, or maybe it's a hobby that you have in common. Maybe it is a background that you share, or a history that you share with each other. Whatever it is, friendships never sort of spontaneously emerge out of nowhere, and certainly they don't continue for a long time with nothing between them. No, friendships always have a common passion. C.S. Lewis, who wrote this book called The Four Loves, talks about friendship extendedly in it. Here's what he says. He says, friendship arises out of companionship when two or more of the companions discover that they have in common some insight or interest or even taste which the others do not share and which till that moment each believed to be his unique treasure. The typical expression of opening friendship would be something like, what? You two? I thought I was the only one. You see what he's saying there? He's saying, look, friendship is not just about friendship. It's not about two people saying, shall we be friends? Let's do our best to be friends. It's about two people discovering a shared passion that they have, or a shared journey maybe that they're on, and discovering it together. So he goes on. Forgive the slightly straight-talking nature of the language here, but he says this. That is why those pathetic people who simply want friends can never make any. The very condition of having friends is that we should want something else beside friends. Where the truthful answer to the question, do you see the same truth, would be, I see nothing, and I don't care about the truth, I only want a friend, no friendship can arise. There would be nothing for the friendship to be about, and friendship must be about something, even if it were only an enthusiasm for dominoes or white mice. Those who have nothing can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. Friendship is formed around a common direction, or a common pursuit, or a common passion. Which means, I think, by implication, that friendship is not founded on a kind of chemistry of some sort, or just a click that we feel with certain people, that sense of it just felt right. Now, don't hear me wrong. I'm not saying that some sort of enjoyment of each other's personalities is irrelevant to friendship. It is relevant. It's often important. But it won't be the sustaining power behind a friendship. I think that is a trap that we often fall into. We sort of sit back in life waiting for the people with whom we're going to have that click, with whom we will have that chemistry, and often miss the opportunity to grow in real and deep friendships. I slightly tonight, this morning, want to blow up the chemistry idea, because I think it can be crippling to us in finding and forming new friendships. Crippling because it means, like I say, we sit on the edge of life waiting for the chemistry to happen, when if we just dived in and got on with it, we would find true and lasting friendships forming. Because I don't think there is any promise in the Bible or anywhere else that if we start friendships, it will just feel right. or that we should start friendships because it just feels right. But I think there is a promise that if we find a common passion, then that is the beginning of a genuine friendship. See, friendship isn't founded on chemistry. It's founded, Jesus would say, on a common passion. Which means that as Christians, we're already friends. We're already friends. I got a yes. Because if your deepest passion is Jesus Christ and the gospel, and my deepest passion is Jesus Christ and the gospel, then everything is in place. Well, to put it differently, if Jesus is your friend and Jesus is my friend, then we should get together. All we need to do is just discover that about each other. And the reason I think sometimes we don't is because we're slow to speak about Jesus with each other. Again, to take it into a different area of life, I think we know this in our experience often. We discover that common passion. Forgive me, this is probably a more blokey illustration, but if a group of blokes are gathered together and enjoy talking about football, which isn't always the case, but if they do, one of the first things people will say is, which team do you support? Right? And if I'm in a group and I say Manchester United, which is what I do say, friends, straight away. Then the other person says, me too, instantly there's a connection between us. And even if we're in a bigger group, we'll start wanting to talk to each other. And if we're in a bigger group and the rest of the people are not Manchester United fans, all of a sudden what will happen is we'll start getting together and kind of defending ourselves against the rest of the group because we've got this thing in common all of a sudden. The ground is there. We've just got to discover it with each other. And we could replicate that, I suspect, with lots of other hobbies and passions and things we get excited about. But what we all have in common in this room is, of course, the gospel of Jesus Christ. We just got to get good at discovering it about each other, being quick to speak about our common faith, being willing to say to each other, hey, tell me, how did you become a Christian? Love to know your story. I've got this thing going on in my life at the moment. I'm just trying to work through at the moment. Can you just give me your thoughts as a Christian? What would you do if you were in my shoes? I find it tough sometimes to keep going. How do you keep going? Can you just encourage me in this? All kinds of different ways that if we were just a little bit better to speak, a bit quicker to speak about our faith, we would find friendships growing. This is why at the heart of our small groups at Crossway is the Bible, is God's words. We don't take an approach to small groups that says, let's find all the people, all the people who like playing frisbee, let's put them in one group. All the people who like going for walks in the country, we'll put them in another group. You like cooking? You're a foodie? Great, we've got a group for foodies. Now, don't get me wrong, it's lovely if you like sharing those hobbies, get together, enjoy them together. That's a wonderful thing together. But our small groups, as organized by us as a church, have God's word at the center of them. Because we're convinced that as we explore and discover and enjoy our common passion with each other, in a commitment to doing that with each other, so our friendships and our relationships will grow. Someone said in the friendship survey, could we talk a little bit about friendships across different ethnicities and cultures? Well, this, I think, is the key to friendships across our different cultures and backgrounds that we all come from. Remembering the gospel of Jesus Christ that is our deepest passion. Because in a sense, it doesn't matter what background you come from and I come from. If we discover that we both love Jesus, then there is that instant point of connection for each other. And as we come together and enjoy that point of connection, all of the other things, as important as they are about us, become secondary things and things that we don't need to let divide us. You see, the nature of the gospel of Jesus Christ is that we have an unconditional forgiveness from him and a new identity in him. As human beings, normally speaking, we're very self-justifying and self-defensive. And we tend, therefore, to think the culture that I'm from is the best culture. Or to put it more personally, the way that I am is the best way. It's good for you that you're the way you are, but the way that I am is the best way. And we can, therefore, slightly divide from people because we tend to think in those ways. Like, your culture's fine, but I like my culture, so I'm going to err more towards that. But our new identity in Jesus Christ means that actually I don't need to be self-defensive about my culture. My fundamental identity isn't the fact that I'm from the background that I'm from. And that liberates me to move towards you. I don't have to be defensive about myself. You don't have to be defensive about yourself. And in fact, we can enjoy and appreciate what's different about each other. We have this common connection and then this resource that enables us to move towards each other and enjoy each other rather than divide and separate. The key to cross-cultural friendships is putting Jesus Christ at the center and enjoying him. Someone else said, oh, can we talk about friendships between different ages and stages? I think the same principles apply. As we get further apart in age and stage, differences accrue. That's just kind of how it happens, doesn't it? You get older and older, you get immersed in different kind of cultural subsets just by nature of growing older. The same realities can bed in. You think, oh, the way we did it in my day is way better than the way these young people do it. So you become a bit defensive and you back off from each other. But the gospel enables you to see and distill and discern what's good, what's bad, what's necessary, what's not necessary, and to move towards each other in love. Yeah, it requires a certain proactivity. It requires a certain moving out of our comfort zones. But there's no reason why, as Christians, we can't just begin to take steps towards older people and younger people and form genuine friendships. As Christians, friendship is just waiting for us to discover. All we need to do is proactively pursue it. The person waiting for the click or the chemistry could be waiting for a very long time and in the end won't discover true and lasting friendship. The person who goes looking is guaranteed to find it. Friendship is about a common passion, first of all. But secondly, friendship is also about a commitment to serving each other. Again, we see that in John 15. So John 15, verse 12, Jesus says, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you." Now, obviously, with Jesus, there is something of a kind of asymmetry with our friendship with him, right? He's also the king of the universe. So he can say, "You should do what I command you." But at the same time, he lays down his life for us, right? So it's not a domineering or dominating nature to that friendship. But what is in common is that both sides of that relationship are willing to serve the other. We will do what he commands us. He will lay down his life for us. And then Jesus says to his disciples, "I want you to follow in my footsteps." This is the example at the heart of relationship, or verse 12, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." And so deep, lasting friendship will be about a common commitment to serving each other. Aristotle was a philosopher who wrote what's called the Nicomachean Ethics. I was talking to Michael about this, who was telling me why it's called that. It's called the here he is. Right on cue. This is your bit, Michael. Nicomachean Ethics, so-called because his dad was called Nicomachus and his son was called Nicomachus. And he wrote this book to teach his son what the good life looked like. And he wrote a lot about friendship in it. And he outlined three types of friendship. He said, first of all, there's a friendship that is based on utility, based on usefulness. You might be friends with the person who serves you your sandwich every day. You get to know them a little bit. You're friends with your mechanic, the person who mends your car. It's a kind of utilitarian relationship. It's got usefulness to it, but there's a relationship there that you could call a friendship of some sorts. Then he says there are relationships or friendships based on pleasure. Those are the ones we talked about a moment ago. We love watching football together. We love walking in the country together. We love talking about good food together. Those are relationships based on pleasure. But he said in his book that the third and the highest form of friendship is a friendship that is based on shared values, talked about that already, a common passion, and that is all about selfless love. That is all about selfless love. Freddie wants for Barney what is good for Barney, first and foremost. Now, the Bible also recognizes different types of friendship. So in Proverbs chapter 14, verse 20, it says this: the poor is disliked by his neighbor, but the rich has many friends. You see what the proverb is saying there? The person who's wealthy will gather to them lots of people who seem to like them and want to be around them. You can see in the heart of the proverb that there's a kind of superficiality to that friendship, so-called. It's the kind of friendship that, of, you know, we say, don't we, then he really found out who his friends were. They're the kind of friends who drop off. They might be friendships based on utility, Aristotle would say. But in common with Aristotle, the Bible recognizes very definitely that highest form of friendship, a friendship based on shared values and selfless love. Jesus says, love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Or Proverbs 17, verse 17 says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. True friendship, the deepest form of friendship, is expressed in a commitment to serving each other. Which means, I think it's true to say, that deep friendship cannot start with the question, what's in it for me? It can't start with the question, what's in it for me? But rather must start with the question, what's in it for them? That's how deep and lasting friendship will form. And there's got to be a mutuality to that. There's got to be a sense in which that commitment to serve cuts both ways. Maybe not in equal measure or equal proportion. Maybe not in a balanced way all of the time. A friend is there in adversity, says the Proverbs. But nonetheless, that never begins with one half waiting for the other to come and serve them. Deep friendship starts by asking the question, what's in it for them? And again, I think we know that. I don't think I need to persuade you that that's true or that's real. You know the Friends theme tune? I think we all know about Friends, don't we? Like, I grew up with it, but I think it transcends our different cultural moments. What does the theme tune say? It says, you'll be there for me. No, it doesn't, does it? It says, I'll be there for you. Right? We recognize this. This is the heart of true friendship. Not an expectation, you'll be there for me, but a commitment, I'll be there for you. And we've all been through that gear change in relationship, haven't we, with friends, when we've gone through a tough time. You go through a tough time, and your friends draw near to you and help you through that tough time, and your friendship with them goes through a gear change, doesn't it? It goes into the higher gears. The friendship becomes a deeper one as you say, or they say to you, I'm going to serve you. And so friendship is not just expressed, but I think it's right to say it is formed through a commitment to serving each other. These are, I think, the two pillars of friendship as the Bible understands it. A common passion and a commitment to serving each other. And as we go on in our conversation about friendship, I think we need to get clear on the difference between the roots and the fruits. We long for, rightly, relational closeness. We want to have intimacy. We want to have togetherness. We want to have shared joy and laughter and experiences and all of those kind of things. But sometimes I think we assume that that's the root. That's where it's going to start. But those things that I've just talked about, that closeness, that intimacy, that joy, that laughter, those experiences, those are the fruits. And the roots are what we've been talking about, a common passion and a commitment to serve. And so let me encourage you, before we head to coffee and start talking in more depth about these things, let me encourage you to raise your view of friendship in the first place. The Bible thinks it is a very, very wonderful thing. J.C. Ryle, who was a bishop up in Liverpool during the 18th century, he said this. He said, this world is full of sorrow because it's full of sin. It is a dark place. It is a lonely place. It is a disappointing place. The brightest sunbeam in it is a friend. Friendship halves our troubles and doubles our joys. C.S. Lewis said, the chief happiness, that friendship is the chief happiness in life. He said this, perhaps half of all the happiness in the world is friendship. And I think if you reflect on that, you think it's true. Let me encourage you, raise friendship in your eyes and in your expectations. If you've got it, don't give it up. If you lack it, go pursuing it. But do it on the right terms. Do it remembering that it is a common passion that will bring you together and grow you together. And it is a commitment to serve that is the healthy footing on which to start. Those are the roots of friendship. And if they are healthy, then the fruit will be wonderful. So let me pray. Father, we thank you again for Jesus. We thank you for his friendship towards us, that he would share with us the words of eternal life, that he would share with us his perfect eternal relationship with you. We thank you, Lord, that we get to call you our friend. And we thank you, Lord, that in his friendship we see the perfect pattern of friendship, that he would share those things with us, that he would commit to serving us in that way. And so we ask, Lord, that we would follow in his footsteps as we seek to grow and cultivate friendships. Help us, Lord, to be people who recognize what we have in common and to really celebrate and enjoy that with each other. And we ask, as we do that, you would breed in us a commitment to serving each other, to being there for each other in the good times and in the tough times, that you would grow us together to an enjoyment of the friendships that we can have. And we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.